From the Moon Broadcast Center, it's Film Week. I'm Larry Mantle with critics Tim Cogshell, Leah Lowenstein, and Charles Solomon. We'll hear their views of the romantic comedy Long Shot, starring Charlize Theron and Seth Rogen, the animated comedy adventure Ugly Dolls, The Intruder, a horror mystery film from director Dion Taylor, and El Chicano, a drama set in East L.A., all on Film Week. It's Film Week on 89.3 KPECC. I'm Larry Mantle. Wonderful to have you with us. I'm joined by film critics Leo Lowenstein, Tim Cogshell of All Film Guide and Cinegods.com, and Charles Solomon of Animation Scoop and Animation Magazine. We begin with the romantic comedy Long Shot, starring Charlize Theron and Seth Rogen. Jonathan Levine directs a screenplay written by Liz Hanna and Dan Sterling. Rogen plays average Joe journalist Fred Flarsky, whose chance encounter with his childhood crush, now the Secretary of State and preparing a presidential run, lands him a job as one of her speech writers. Romantic sparks ensue.
In order to write better for you, I should kind of get to know you better if you have a minute.
I actually have seven.
7 minutes in heaven. What is your favorite
book as a kid?
The Velveteen Rabbit.
Favorite song?
Must Have Been Love by Roxette.
Most embarrassing moment?
I don't embarrass that easily.
I don't either, really.
What's your favorite sexual position?
Normal? Front-facing normal?
What kind of question
That's
is that?
That's all it took. Look at you.
What's your favorite sexual position?
Don't be gross, Frank.
Long Shot, directed by Jonathan Levine. Leo, what'd you think?
This movie shouldn't have worked as well as it did, but it was terrific. It had everything that you want in a romantic comedy right now and a lot more. It had great sparks between Charlize Theron and Seth Rogen. It had some biting political satire. It had snappy dialogue. It's the kind of movie that even people, let's say guys who don't like romantic comedies, would like this movie. I mean, it's basically Pretty Woman kind of redux. You have these two completely mismatched people who get thrown together, and because of the underlying chemistry and really particularly Charlize Theron, I think, doing the icy blonde so well, and then Seth Rogen doing his sort of goofy, idealistic journalist, they just come together and, they make it work.
Yeah. Chemistry, which I would have not predicted. This is why I'm not a studio executive. If you come to me and you say, look, we've got this romantic comedy. It's going to be Seth Rogen and Charlize Theron. I'll fire you, right? Get out of my office.
You red-lighted this right away.
You're nuts. But yet, there it is on the screen, Seth and Charlize, with this wonderful chemistry and this truly delightful, wonderfully written movie.
I mean, I thought it worked way better than, say, Rogan and Katherine Heigl. And
no.
You like them better?
No.
Oh,
this is far and away better.
This is way better. But this is just a better all-around movie. I mean, it's totally implausible, but it's plausibly implausible, right?
Jonathan Levine, he made a movie called The Whackness about 10 years ago. It was one of my favorite comedies. It was really, really wonderful. And, of course, this is Liz Hanna, wrote The Post and Reign Over Me, the biography of The Post. She knows the political stuff very, very well. And the dialogue is just so snappy and biting and funny.
But it's also worth mentioning what a terrific supporting cast. O'Shea Jackson Jr. as Rogan's best friend and coming in with some surprising sort of third act twists. And also just her assistant, all the characters, I thought, incredibly well cast, and it just moves like a fast train.
Now, I like it despite the sort of progressive proselytizing, because it is, right? It's a little bit right-wing bashing. Usually I don't like it when these movies do that. I prefer it when, like, a Primary Colors. If you're gonna poke fun at something, poke fun at yourself.
But, Tim, I disagree. I think that's what it mocked at one point. I think it mocked the kind of movies that do bash the right wing, and that's what I'm alluding to, but I can't get into too
much. Well, yeah, it does sort of complete the circle a little bit, but it's plainly a sort of left-leaning liberal sort of filmmakers.
Well, yes, and the president, the sitting president, is sort of a Trumpian former TV star, actually, who wants to
leave the presidency
to be in movies.
Yeah, because it's a tougher jump.
Yeah, it's a big jump.
Long Shot, the film from director Jonathan Levine. It's rated R in wide release. Ugly Dolls, an animated adventure comedy, is directed by Kelly Asbury. Alison Peck wrote the screenplay. An ensemble of voice actor cast of Kelly Clarkson, Pitbull, Blake Shelton, Wanda Sykes, and others, about a group of factory-rejected dolls who travel outside their comfortable home of Uglyville, discover what it means to be different in a world demanding perfection.
Ooh, cool glasses. I always wanted some specs.
Ooh, yeah. Excuse me, I feel smarter already.
No. Do I look wiser?
Oh, yeah.
No, please, just... Please.
Huh?
We're sorry.
Please don't say anything, guys. Especially not to Lou.
Lots of dolls wear glasses in Uglyville. Even Five-Eyed Steve.
This is the Institute of Perfection. And perfect dolls have perfect eyesight.
Ugly Dolls is rated PG. Charles?
Well, I would have liked to have asked the woman from the MPAA, why do they object to children being exposed to things like nudity or profanity and have no qualms about sending them to a 90-minute commercial for toys disguised as an entertainment, which is what this is. This is just to promote this particular line of unattractive toys. The story borrows shamelessly, and borrows is a nice word for it, from the three Toy Story movies, in some cases almost shot for shot, and from Tin Toy, the Pixar short that kicked off, was sort of the rough draft for what would become Toy Story. Shots of where Moxie, the heroine of this, is imagining belonging to a child, and there's a scene of her being lifted in silhouette, sort of riding something like Jessie and the Horse. The toys have to go through an audition that's a mechanical setup like the one for the scare trials in Monsters, Inc. They face an enormous mechanical baby that looks remarkably like the baby in Tin Toy. I guess it's supposed to teach you to embrace your inner ugliness, but I wasn't convinced, and it again, it's just so shamelessly lifted, and the only reason it exists is to sell toys.
Yeah, derivative in all those ways. Trite, too, in that storyline, you know, the beauty and all our flaws and all of that, I suppose. But this is the real problem with this movie. This movie's trying to kill us. This movie is coming at you so hard and so fast with songs. People are singing and talking at the same time, and
constantly.
Things are flying. And I'm like, this movie plainly wants me dead. And that's the problem that I have with this movie. I don't know what it's doing to the children. But I can't see how it's good.
But even in that clip, nobody ever shuts up.
Never, never. There is never a static moment in this movies. In this movie, in the song. So and I don't get it, Charles. You tell me.
Question, Charles. Couldn't you actually argue though that any movie since Star Wars that's directed at kids has been sort of had merchandising as its key point?
It's one thing to I think to create a story, and then if people like it and the characters so well, then you can make toys. That's what happened to
Mickey Ness. So you're saying
this is more like Strawberry Shortcake,
right?
Or He-Man, or the Tonka trucks that they built shows around of just based on merchandise.
Right.
Well, the Lego Movie is a prime example.
Yes. but it's
very
worked.
Funny. Yeah.
That was a more particularly the first one was a more successful movie. And it didn't feel like it's just selling Lego. It's just a world built of Lego, in some cases very, very cleverly. This, if it weren't for the toys, there isn't a – it's just not a story.
So the music apparently is all original from the voice act people like Janelle Monáe and Kelly Clarkson.
Asking the wrong person for that.
I really
don't know the
Pitbull.
Yeah. I was not a Pitbull fan going in or coming out. So
you're not?
I can't
right.
comment.
All right. Well, next time you go to Miami. Ugly Dolls, the animated adventure comedy in wide release, rated PG. The Intruder, a horror mystery directed by Dion Taylor. David Lowry is the screenwriter. Michael Ealy and Megan Good are the stars. Tim, what'd you think?
Interesting, this film. So Dion Taylor, I think, has created a very particular niche of filmmaking. He makes these movies about black people in jeopardy of crazy white people. Every film he's made has been exactly that theme. He made a movie called Meet the Blacks, Mike Epps' film. A black family moves to Beverly Hills on the one day that they have this thing called the annual purge. And they're like the only black family in Beverly Hills, which is silly in the first place. Then he made a film called Traffic, Halle Berry and Omar Epps in that film. And they go off to a mountain preserve to have a nice mountain weekend. And they run across this crazy white biker gang that tries to kill them. This movie is about a lovely couple, Megan Good and Michael Ealy. And they buy this house in the deep, deep, deep Napa Valley from Dennis Quaid, the guy that owns the house, the widower. And he turns out to be crazy, a crazy widower, and he tries to kill them. Now, it's all pretty pro forma, except for a couple of nice little hooks, right? So Megan Good's character gets jealous of Michael Ealy. He tends to be a bit of a flirtatious guy. So when Dennis Quaid keeps hanging around the house well after they've sold the house and he should have gone away, she starts flirting with him. Now, flirting with the crazy guy that bought you, that's a bad idea. You don't want to do that. Eventually,
this is where you yell at the screen, don't do it.
What are you doing over there? Anyway, the movie pretty much goes exactly where you think it's going to go. But it's an interesting little niche of cinematic territory that these folks have staked out for themselves. It's fun. Is it brilliant? Is it groundbreaking? No. No, not really at all.
The Intruder from director Dion Taylor is rated PG-13 in wide release. Set in East Los Angeles, though not screened for critics, the drama El Chicano, starring Raul Castillo and Amy Garcia. The film is directed and co-written by Ben Hernandez Bray in his feature directorial debut. Movie's rated R. So we can't tell you about the quality of the film El Chicano, but it is set in East L.A. and it's out there. The documentary Ask Dr. Ruth shows us the life of Dr. Ruth Westheimer as she approaches her 90th birthday. She's both a Holocaust survivor and the country's most famous sex therapist, Ryan White, the director. Lael?
Oh, I've so enjoyed this movie, to my great surprise. I had forgotten really just what an iconic and kind of pivotal figure Dr. Ruth was in our national discussion of sexuality and relationships. I mean, she was, and it actually makes this point in the doc, the first sort of doctor first name. There's Dr. Phil, Dr. Dre, Dr. what, you know. She, yeah.
Dr. Joyce Brothers was probably the first.
But she wasn't just Dr. Joyce.
Right.
No, that's true.
That's Dr. True. Ruth made that trendy, right? And so the doc goes into the fact that before she came along, essentially, women did not discuss their sexuality in public. Sexuality wasn't really talked about in general. She brought in a radio show. She became a TV star. The doc actually opens with a montage of Dr. Ruth with a whole bunch of people who she's outlived. Johnny Carson, Robin Williams, Joan Rivers. And she was at the forefront of our national conversation about relationships. She had her show. She was this little tiny 4'7" woman who kind of changed the way we thought about, and we thought it was okay to talk about, let's see, AIDS, homosexuality, abortion. She made it comfortable.
Orgasms.
She made it yeah, well, you said it. I didn't want to say that.
I'm sorry, Leo.
No. I just wanted to add also that it made me wish that we had someone like Dr. Ruth now, because I think the pendulum has kind of swung back to a sort of a pre-Dr. Ruth kind of way of thinking in some ways.
Certainly in terms of sophisticated conversations. One of the things that she did, she was doing, was talking to women specifically about engaging in and being happy for their sexuality, particularly in 1980.
It was a fabulous thing. Taking responsibility for developing.
Yeah, your own orgasm. That was one of the things. You're responsible for your own orgasm. Now, if she went on television in 1980, I got married in 1981. Let me tell you, Dr. Ruth did a brother a solid for the rest of my entire married life, because this, you know, women my wife's age were educated by her about, this is what we're going to be doing.
She is so clinical, though, that it was like funny to watch.
Well,
because
particularly since she's so energetic. Mm-hmm. She may be, as Lael says, 4'7", but she's got more energy than you know a basketball
player. But it still does.
But it's distinctly not sexual or erotic. It's so clinical.
And she actually talks about that. There's an old clip with Diane Sawyer where Diane Sawyer asks her, why do you think people are willing to listen to you? And she says, you know, maybe because I don't look like you, basically. Maybe because I look like me. But I also wanted to add, it was fascinating to hear her background, you know, growing up as the child of these two parents who were shipped off to concentration camps. She was sent away to an orphanage in Switzerland, and she, you know, had to deal with what it was like to grow up alone, and a lot of kind of sublimating a lot of pain, a lot of angst, and was basically taught, you know, you don't express that kind of pain, but it's okay also at the same time to be yourself. And that's sort of how she came out of it.
She went on one of the Kinder transports. Mm-hmm. That meant that while she lived, she was essentially a servant in a Swiss orphanage to the Swiss orphans. Mm. And she had to fight to get an education. Girls were not allowed to go to the local high school, but she had a boyfriend who was going, and she would read his books at night.
Mm. We're going to continue on this documentary, Ask Dr. Ruth, because it's worth it. Mm-hmm. We're going to talk about Dr. Ruth Westheimer, her influence, and her life. You're listening to Film Week on 89.3 KPECC. Back with more from Charles, Lael, and Tim in just 1 minute. Great to have you with us on Film Week. I'm Larry Mantle with critics Tim Cogshell, Lael Lowenstein, and Charles Solomon. We're in the midst of talking about the documentary Ask Dr. Ruth. It profiles Dr. Ruth Westheimer. If you're someone who's been around television in the past 30-plus years, you've seen her on virtually every talk show you can imagine, America's foremost sex therapist, but with a remarkable life story on top of that. And also, she was married for many, many years.
Yeah, she was married three times.
Mm-hmm. Oh, 3 times. Okay, yeah.
And it was her last husband, whose name she still uses, and who was the one she seemed to care about the most, and they had a long and very obviously very happy marriage, and she still has kids and grandkids who talk about, she came. You know, she came and talked to my class once, and I'm still trying to live it down. But again, there was an honesty to what she did at a time when Reagan was ignoring AIDS. Mm. She was talking about the need for research and a cure and compassion in the mass media, and she was similarly bold again in her treatment of female sexuality. And that this was not something to be hidden or brushed over or ignored, that it was significant and important, and that individuals had to act on it and do things.
Let's talk about the filmmaking itself. Lael, what did you think, and beyond her being an interesting subject?
Right. Extensive use of archival footage, which was great. You know, all the shows that she's been on, you know, as well as, and she kept everything. She kept her diaries from when she was a child, letters from her parents. And actually, Charles, I wanted to ask you about this. The use of animation as for flashbacks I thought was really interesting. And I'm so glad they didn't do recreations, because I can't stand when that's done. But I thought that was a really clever way to, they would take a picture of her, for instance, and then sort of morph that into an animated image. And that was a really nice way to sort of take us back
in time.
Well,
who could play her in a...
Right. Yes. There's only one Dr. Ruth.
There aren't that many 4'7" actresses, I don't think. But the problem I had with that is I thought the footage of her was so much more compelling that if they had just kept her talking and shown you the documents, that would have worked.
It was directed by Ryan White, who directed Serena, a very good movie about Serena Williams a couple of years ago, and a wonderful movie called Good Old Frida, about Frida Kelly, who was the secretary for the Beatles.
Oh, I love that movie.
For her
entire
life.
Really
so
good.
He has this way about him of digging into things, but Dr. Ruth is the thing here. Her last memory of her father is seeing him being arrested by the Nazis the night after Kristallnacht. And she never saw him again. And she only realized that her the rest of her family had been lost probably in Auschwitz in 1942.
Because she goes to the archives in Israel and is able to determine he was killed in 1942 at Auschwitz. There's no record of what became of her mother or her grandmother.
Yeah, but the point is it also makes her an incredibly contemporary figure, as well as someone whose lifespan has covered a tremendous amount of time and change. So What a remarkable woman. I was really surprised.
Ask Dr. Ruth, a documentary as her 90th birthday approaches, takes a look at her childhood and her adult experience as a very influential sex therapist. The documentary, directed by Ryan White, it's at selected theaters and unrated. The documentary Meeting Gorbachev, a German documentary directed by Werner Herzog and Andre Singer. Tim?
Perfect person to direct this documentary. Gorbachev is in the movie. Werner is talking to him most of the time, and Werner does the voiceover for the film. He brings a certain sort of deep, deep truthfulness, verisimilitude. When Werner is talking, you simply believe what he's saying because he seems to be wholly and completely incapable of telling a lie or saying things that aren't actually literally true. As you see them. So when it's just really, really interesting to hear him speak about these things. So this is particularly interesting. If you were an adult or a person who was coming of age in the late 70s, early 80s, as we saw the old guard of the Soviet Union, Brezhnev, sort of crumbling. So Brezhnev, and then there were two more Soviet leaders, each lasted about a year after him, and then Gorbachev. Mm. And with Gorbachev came this notion of perestroika, a sort of restructuring of society in general, and glasnost, opening up freedom of the press, things like that. Now, ultimately, both of those things were his undoing, but they were also the undoing of the Soviet Union. Interesting to me that everything we're watching that's going on then, and I was in the Air Force then, and the Soviet Union was our most strategic enemy. Everything that was going on then is going on again now. We see the restructuring. Interesting that he is of Russian and Ukrainian descent. Particularly today, when we know what went on in Ukraine. He's very, very critical of he was critical of Yeltsin. He is very critical of Putin. And Russians are very split on him, though he is very much loved in the West.
All right. Meeting Gorbachev. Leo, what do you think?
I liked the doc. I was intrigued by Herzog's part in it. You know, he's such an compelling character in and of himself. Larry, I think you've had him on the show. He actually inserts himself into the interview so that it's really much more about his relationship with Gorbachev almost than about Gorbachev himself. He's got all these sort of witty little observations.
I always find him very entertaining.
He's very, I'm thinking back to Grizzly Man, which was a long time ago, but I love that film as well. Tim, you're right. I mean, the whole reminding us about perestroika, the economic reform, and then the policy of openness, the glasnost, was brought back to the fore here. Also, the way Gorbachev kind of very cannily courted Reagan and Thatcher, even to the point where he was almost like his own publicist. There's this discussion of how, you know, after the meeting in Reykjavik with Reagan, you know, it was thought that maybe Gorbachev was going to be upset that it didn't go quite the way he wanted. But he came out and said, oh, yes, we consider it a success. And so then after he said that, then Reagan's people were like, oh, yeah, right, we do consider it a success. So he was able to sort of use that to his advantage. And it also goes into really nicely his relationship with his lovely and very accomplished wife, Raisa Gorbachev. So I this was a good doc.
Meeting Gorbachev from filmmaker Werner Herzog, Andre Singer. It's unrated at the New Art Theater, West L.A. The biographical drama, extremely wicked, shockingly evil and vile. The story of Ted Bundy. Joe Berlinger is the director of the film. Elizabeth Kendall wrote the screenplay. Tim?
Based on a biography by Liz Cuffler, I think is how you say her name. So this woman met.
I think the book's actually written by Michael Werwe. Is that right?
I think the memoir is Liz Kendall's memoir.
Oh, okay.
Is Liz Kendall's memoir, and she's a character in this narrative. So this young woman, a single mother, meets Ted Bundy, played by Zac Efron in this movie in 1974, and she has a relationship with him, both as his girlfriend for several years, and then an ongoing relationship with him after he's arrested for murders in Colorado and Utah, and is in contact with him for the rest of his life until he's executed in 1989. Much of this story is told from her point of view, as a woman who, with a small child, lived with and was in love with Ted Bundy. When he was arrested for and even convicted of some of these murders, she stuck by him. She went through several of those trials. Eventually, when she did actually separate from him, he would call her. He would call her from Florida when he was going through all that stuff. So all of that was, he got arrested in Florida in 1979. And this is most of the Ted Bundy story that we've come to be familiar with, that period, that last period. Everything that happened before that is chronicled in this movie, and it's fascinating. The title comes from something that the judge in that Florida trial called him. What's not in this movie is a lot of kill scenes, a lot of murder scenes, but there is one moment in this movie that I found extremely upsetting, where they show us an image. And it's an image that I did not expect to see, particularly given the rest of the movie. Disturbed me deeply. And that's, and I know people, other people are talking about different things that bug them about this movie. There are other controversies. Funny that the one thing that's controversial about this movie is an image that's in this movie to me, not the other stuff.
Extremely Wicked, Shockingly Evil and Vile is on Netflix. The film is rated R. You can see it as well at the Vintage Los Feliz Theater. The documentary At the Heart of Gold, Inside the USA Gymnastics Scandal, is directed by Aaron Lee Carr. It's an HBO documentary. Lael?
This is a tough subject, of course, but it is a really important documentary. This is about the scandal that brought down not just Dr. Larry Nassar, who was this horrific pedophile who abused hundreds of gymnasts, but also the USA Gymnastics Association, which allowed this behavior to go on for years and years. What surprised me here was the extent to which there's a certain kind of like institutionalized or kind of systemic abuse that goes on with these gymnasts. And they are interviewed in the film. They talk, many of them, very, very openly about how they're taught from a very young age that if it hurts you, it must be good for you. In other words, if it hurts you, it makes you stronger. That's the whole sort of premise of becoming a top, top gymnast. And there's actually footage of them doing something called racking, which is where you're sort of pressed down and into a like a, an incredibly painful like splits position. We see these gymnasts training over and over and, you know, hitting themselves, getting knocked about. Into that came Dr. Larry Nassar, who was a kind of a goofy, dorky, but sort of friendly guy who these gymnasts and their families would take under their wing and sort of decide that they wanted to get close to. What they didn't realize was what he was doing to these kids. He would actually include the parents in the first examination. So the parents became unwittingly complicit in what was going on. And it's just, it's horrific. The sexual abuse, the tacit acceptance. Some of these young women complained many, many years ago before this scandal broke, and they were told, you know, he's just doing what he does. Dr. Larry, he's actually good for the team. He helps us. He'll make you get stronger and make you get better. It is cathartic towards the end of the film, by the way, because a lot of these women get to express themselves and you get to see their courtroom testimony. So it's a very, very well done piece. It's hard to watch, but it's important to see.
At the Heart of Gold, Inside the USA Gymnastics Scandal premieres on HBO this weekend, also at Lemley's Playhouse Pasadena. It's unrated. Bolden, the story of New Orleans, cornet player Buddy Bolden, Gary Carr, Eric Leray, Harvey Starr, Daniel Pritzker directed and co-wrote it. Tim?
Yeah. The story of Buddy Bolden. Buddy Bolden, interesting figure in the history of jazz. A lot of folks call him the father of jazz. Not really. He's the father of a particular sort of old style ragtime cornet playing. No one has ever heard any Buddy Bolden because Buddy Bolden never recorded. We do have disciples of Buddy Bolden, King Oliver, Louis Armstrong among them. The only other film that Dan Pritzker made is a film called Louis, which was about Louis Armstrong. In that film, Buddy Bolden was played by Anthony Mackie. Pritzker, J. Pritzker Foundation, Pritzker family, the Hyatt family. Dan is a billionaire. Dan likes jazz. So Dan has made two films about this thing that he's interested in. It's okay. It's an artfully made film. It's not a wonderful film. It has more in common with Bird than, say, Ray.
Yeah.
But it's not brilliant. But it does give a bit of a history about this figure about which we know very little.
Bolden is the film. It's rated R in select theaters. This week, we lost Peter Mayhew, who played Chewbacca in the Star Wars films. He passed away at the age of 74. Let's go back to Star Wars Episode VI, Return of the Jedi. Han Solo, Harrison Ford, reunited with his pal Chewie in a dungeon after being captured by Imperial forces.
Chewie, is that you? Chewie! I can't see, pal. What's going on?
Luke. Luke's crazy.
He can't even take care of himself, much less rescue anybody.
A Jedi Knight. I'm out of it. For a little while, everybody gets delusions of grandeur.
All right, pal.
That's a performance by Peter Mayhew, who so many of his fellow cast members in the Star Wars films talked about what a kind, terrific person he was, in addition to creating the indelible character of Chewbacca. Coming up, we remember John Singleton, the filmmaker who died earlier this week, Boys in the Hood, his classic, among other films, that to come. Hit song for Janet Jackson from the John Singleton film, Poetic Justice. Singleton suffered a massive stroke just about 2 weeks ago, went into a coma and passed away at the age of 51. Singleton, with a huge impact with his films set here in Los Angeles, exploring issues of the black community in L.A. for those of us that grew up here, a real sense of place, a real sense of complex human beings, in particular time in Los Angeles. Singleton nailed that beautifully with his characters, his screenplays, and his direction. Boys in the Hood, of course, what brought him to prominence, his very first feature film. And this powerful scene with Lawrence Fishburne and Cuba Gooding Jr. as Fishburne's son.
Trey? Trey, what are you doing? Huh? Oh, you bad now, huh? You bad. You gotta shoot somebody now, huh? Well, here I am. Come on, shoot me. You bad, right? Look, I'm sorry about your friend. My heart goes out to his mother and his family, but that's their problem, Trey. You my son. You my problem. I want you to give me the gun. Oh, I see. You want to end up like little Chris in a wheelchair, huh? Right? No. You want to end up like Doughboy, huh? No? Give me the motherfucking gun, Trey.
Lawrence Fishburne, Cuba Gooding Jr. in a classic scene from Boys in the Hood, nominated for Best Director for that film. John Singleton, I think the youngest to have that honor. KPCC film critic Tim Cockshill joining us to remember the wonderful work that was done by Singleton, who again passed away yesterday at the age of 51. Tim, just your thoughts about his passing, because you saw the career over its full arc.
Yeah. I wasn't born here, Larry, but I arrived in 1989, before there was a John Singleton, and I watched the entire arc of that, of his career as it happened. Boys in the Hood, I did the junket for that. I worked the red carpet for that. I interviewed him for that movie and every other subsequent movie for the next, almost 30 years. My heart goes out to his mother, with whom I'm acquainted. I would see John occasionally just in Hollywood, and informal subjects, and we would just chit-chat about movies. John loved movies. The reason why that scene is so good, people forget sometimes because he made his bones as a director. John went to USC as a writing student. He got his degree as a writer. He was a wonderful writer. And that scene is beautiful because it's beautifully written. He loved John Ford films. That had a very sort of Gary Cooper quality.
I was going to say, that's not a gangster film scene. That's a Western scene.
Yeah. He was well-educated in cinema and knew a whole lot about movies. Those first few films, John wanted to talk about his community. Boys in the Hood was a film about South Central Los Angeles. So John was doing there what Spike had done for East Coast filmmakers a few years earlier. He made a film about his community, the people in his community, people like him. There's so much truth in Boys in the Hood. It's why it resonates to this very day. The same thing with the next few films, Poetic Justice, the film that gave us Tupac Shakur as an actor and Janet Jackson as a significant actress. A beautiful scene in that film with Maya Angelou where they visit a picnic. They sort of crash this family picnic, and they're accepted right into the group of the family because, you know, black folks look at each other and say, okay, come on in and have some food. And Uncle Joey, a beautiful, beautiful scene, again, full of truth and verisimilitude, and that's one of the things that John was so, so good at.
Came out of Blair High School in Pasadena. Pasadena City College, as you just said, Tim, accepted into the very prestigious writers program. This was a young man that people seemed to know he was going places. When you hear people talk about him as a young man, he was out hustling, working as a PA on different projects. He worked on Arsenio Hall's talk show where he met a lot of people. I mean, he really had a sense of where he wanted to go.
Yeah, interesting. He pointed himself at filmmaking second. Wanted to study to be a computer technologist first. It was a big thing in the early 90s. Everybody was doing it. But it didn't take him very long to realize that he had a knack for storytelling. And he pointed himself at that, and he never took his foot off the gas. Recently, John has been just shepherding all kinds of talent, young talent. He has a series on called Snowfall about the arrival of cocaine in South, what we used to call South Central Los Angeles. A beautiful, beautiful television series. If you look at the names of the directors and the producers in that series, you're going to see a whole lot of names of young black men and women that John said, you can do it. And he gave them a shot. He let them jump. So that's what he's been doing lately, and it's just so, so wonderful.
51 years of age, such a young man to lose John Singleton. Another film that I really loved, and it just seemed like it came and went, didn't get a lot of attention, was Baby Boy, again, set in South Los Angeles. Just to me, again, so captured the characters, the sense of place.
Yeah. Another film where John was writing about his community, full of characters that reflected the folks that he knew, his cousins, his friends. And I got to tell you, as an African-American, I saw all of my cousins and uncles in that movie, too. And I know that you, Larry, from Inglewood, were familiar with that. So John wasn't afraid to do that.
These were people I knew, too. I just felt like these... And it's so rare to see people like that in a movie, like, yeah, I know these folks.
Yeah. John wasn't afraid to do that. Some black filmmakers over the years have shied away from the notion of enfranchising what might have been thought to be stereotypes about black folks in the community. But John was able to capture these people with a truth and in a reality that didn't represent any sort of a stereotype, but just a reality of what was in the neighborhood. But he also captured the family and the heart and the dignity of the community as well. The whole nation got to see, for the first time, this is what it's like to live in an inner city urban community.
Tim Cockshell, KPCC Film Week critic, joining us as we talk about the death of John Singleton at the age of 51, first African-American director nominated for an Oscar, that for Boys in the Hood. Finally, Tim, he wasn't shy about criticizing the film industry for how black people's stories are told. You know, he was very critical and felt that there'd been neglect in that area. You've also been, you know, very, very clear about your critique of how Hollywood, you think, has neglected those stories. Do you see any change on that front?
I do. A significant change, too. Not only when it comes to African-Americans, but when it comes to women, there are... The problem now doesn't happen to be with black folks. It happens to be with women and other people of color. But for African-Americans, there has been opportunity that led us up to Barry Jenkins, that led us up to Black Panther, that led us through Beale Street. Beautiful, beautiful movies that are being recognized now, not just by black folks, but by brown folks, too. So, yeah, John is definitely part of that path that has brought us to where we are now in Hollywood. And for people of color in Hollywood, it is much better than it was in 1989, 1991, when John made that first movie.
Well, and sadly, there's just so much more great work that he would have done had we had him longer.
I can only tell you that if you look at John Singleton's IMDb, you will be deeply impressed. Don't just look at the director's credit. Look at the producer's credit.
A lot of stuff.
Hustle and Flow, Black Snake, Moan, Woo, so many television shows. John Singleton, executive producer. Giving his credibility, his name to those projects made those projects happen.
Tim, thanks so much. Appreciate your coming and talking with us about the legacy of John Singleton, who's left us all too young at 51.
Indeed.
KPECC Film Week critic Tim Cogshell joining us as we remember John Singleton on Film Week. Coming up, we'll talk with the director of Hustle and Flow and Black Snake Moan, Craig Brewer. Singleton produced Brewer's films. He's also a longtime friend of Singleton. And Boys in the Hood producer Stephen Nicolaitis joins us as well. Also, I hope to see you coming up on Saturday, July 27th, for our next Film Week screening. It's at the Theater at Ace Hotel in downtown Los Angeles. We'll be showing Paul Thomas Anderson's 1997 movie Boogie Nights, starring Mark Wahlberg, Julianne Moore, and Burt Reynolds. And after the screening, we'll have a conversation with special guests. You won't want to miss it. Tickets on sale right now at kpecc.org/in-person. Back in just 1 minute.
One in a million, funk for your baby. One in a million.
It's Film Week on 89.3 KPCC. I'm Larry Mantle. We're remembering the life and career of director John Singleton, who died earlier this week at the age of 51. In addition to his directing credit, Singleton also produced a number of notable films and TV series. Features he produced included Hustle and Flow back in 2005. The following year was Black Snake Moan he produced. Craig Brewer was the director of both of those films. Earlier this week, we spoke with him, and I asked him to summarize Singleton's legacy.
The greatest part of his legacy is how much he helped others create their own legacy. I'm one of those guys that I owe my career to John Singleton. There's a lot of people that owe their careers to John Singleton. I work with Taraji P. Henson, Terrence Howard. I work with 3-6 Mafia, and all. I mean, there's so many other actors and artists that some of the greatest moments of their life in their career would not have happened if John hadn't given us an opportunity. In Hollywood, that doesn't happen much. And John was a person that had to connect with you on a what he would call a soulful level. You know, I think that that's something that when John read Hustle and Flow and saw my first movie that I had made on a pawn shop bot camera, he was like, you know, this isn't like a black film. This isn't a white film. You're from Memphis, Tennessee. You're from like the South, and you're not. Your stories aren't really being represented. And that's why he got behind me. A lot of people don't know this, but, you know, every studio closed their doors to Stephanie Elaine, the producer, and John and myself. And it was John who put his house up for Collateral.
Wow.
And financed Hustle and Flow on his own. That's the biggest mistake that people say you can make in the business, is you never put your own money in anything.
Yeah, and he did. With Black Snake Moan, you had a film that there's some controversy about the themes that are there. It definitely has an edge. It's extremely unconventional, the film. And how did John, in his conversations with you, Craig, sort of frame how you were going to respond to that?
I'm going to have to go back one film to answer that. I was very new to Hollywood with Hustle and Flow, and John knew that. He was not only a mentor to me on the set, but he was a mentor to me in how to respond and feel when people respond and criticize and voice their opinions about your film. There's not a class for that. You know, you can be a confident artist or director, but you still feel that kind of anxiety. And so when Hustle started coming out, you know, we had the same kind of controversies. It was like, here's this pimp, and are we really going to see this kind of representation again? And John was the one that really prepped me for that and said, as long as we tell the truth, there's nothing really anybody can say about that. There was a part of John, too. As much as he was an advocate for advancing the conversation about race, there was also a big part of him that was also like against, one could say, like a political correct environment where you couldn't do or say things that he felt were real. So when Black Snake Moan came about and he read it, he immediately wanted to do it. He was like, oh, we're doing this. And he's like, I know everybody's going to be seeing this black man chaining a white woman to a radiator, and they're going to get all mad at you and everything like that. But you have to hold, not only in making the movie, but in representing the movie afterwards, to what we believe in, which is that people that are very different can still connect, love, and get through life together.
We're talking with director Craig Brewer. He directed the feature films Hustle and Flow and Black Snake Moan, films that were produced by the late John Singleton, who died at the age of 51. Singleton, known, of course, as the tremendous young director, 24, of Boys in the Hood, and followed up with Poetic Justice and Baby Boy, did Too Fast, Too Furious, the second installment in that series. But we're talking also about the ways in which he supported other filmmakers in their work. In addition to Craig Brewer, we're joined by Steve Nicolaitis, who is film producer, longtime friend of John Singleton, produced a number of his films, including Boys in the Hood. Steve, first of all, our condolences on the passing of your friend. Just first of all, your feelings about his death.
Oh, boy. I met John. I had just finished working on the movie Misery, and I didn't want to work for a long time. It was the summertime, and Stephanie Lane called me up and said, I just read the greatest script that I've ever read, and you've got to produce this. And I said, just to shut her up, I said, okay, send it to me. And I read it, and I love Westerns. I love morality. I love heroes. And when I read Boys in the Hood, this was a Western. This was morality. And I said, okay, done. I'm there. And then I went to John's mom's house in Pasadena, where I lived. I lived on Hill Avenue for many, many years. And she served us lemonade from her tree. And I said to John, why me? And John said, because you worked on my favorite movie of all time, which was Stand By Me.
Did you have a sense? I mean, here he is in his early 20s. Obviously, you know, the intelligence comes through and the commitment. But did you have any trepidation at all about him helming this project?
Absolutely. His office was next to mine in a little teeny office building in Leimert Park. And I would hear him watching Star Wars and Raiders of the Lost Ark or stuff like that. And I would go in there and say, you know, maybe you should look at American Graffiti and Sugarland Express, because we're not doing Star Wars here. You know, we don't have
no special effects in Boys in the Hood.
Yeah, no, none of that kind of stuff. And but the thing about John is that he listened to you. He took what advice you offered to him. He was never furious about challenging him. He was just a sweetheart, you know. Basically, I mean, all of us who know him, all of us who were especially there at the beginning, know that he was the sweetest knucklehead we ever met in our lives.
We're talking with Steve Nicolaitis, a film producer, longtime friend of John Singleton. He produced several of Singleton's films, including Boys in the Hood, Poetic Justice, and the rebooted Shaft with Samuel L. Jackson. We're also talking with Craig Brewer, the director of Hustle and Flow and Black Snake Moan. Craig, what about, I mean, you talked about the influence that he had on your career and how important he was, but are there a lot of other people like yourself that you'd say that John Singleton was really key to their careers?
Oh, yeah. I was in the writer's room on Empire that I was working on, and the writer's room assistant, this guy Rob Smith, I was talking about something, and I brought up John Singleton. He's like, oh, yeah, man, that's my guy. You know, John Singleton would call me up every once in a while and just give me advice on movies, you know. And I was like, man, you don't know how many times someone has told me that, where John will just call it, like, we'll find out someone's got an interest, and suddenly they got a new big brother.
That's Craig Brewer, the director of the John Singleton-produced films Hustle and Flow and Black Snake Moan. Singleton passed away on Monday at the age of 51 following complications of a stroke that he suffered last month. We were also joined by Steve Nicolaitis, longtime friend of Singleton's, who produced several of his films, including Boys in the Hood. Also with us, KPCC Film Week critic Tim Cogshell. Thank you so much for joining us for another Film Week. From all of us, have a terrific weekend.